I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, seniors at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida held their graduation minus four of their classmates who were gunned down in a massacre that killed 17 people. What is normally a celebratory event was tinged with grief and loss. Our guest novelist Tom McAllister explores the aftermath of a school shooting in his new book, How to Be Safe. It takes place in a small Pennsylvania town, Seldom Falls, and the narrator, Anna Crawford, a fired teacher, is a suspect for the day. The media plunders her private life, and she watches as her community becomes a kind of private state. McAllister has created a memorable character with a shocking sense of humor. She says at one point, in America, we send children to school to get shot and to learn algebra and physics and history and biology and literature. Less civilized nations don't have such an organized system for murdering their children. Tom McAllister joining us on Radio Times, associate professor at Temple University, also nonfiction editor of Barrel House magazine. This is his second novel and his second visit to Radio Times. Tom, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you back. And knowing how common school shootings are, was there a particular one that got you writing this book?
Yeah, for me, it was, I started writing notes on this in the days after the Sandy Hook shooting. Because that one, like a lot of people have noted, was particularly horrifying to watch because of the ages of the victims, and it just seemed like the playbook for the response to it had been set already, and nothing was different at all. And it was, yeah, so I started working then, so I guess that was 2012, early 2012.
What does a novelist, or what can a novelist bring to these horrifying stories you think that the news media can't?
That's a good question. I think the thing that, for me, that I wanted to do was partly to explore my own anxieties and anger and frustration about the situation. But I think also a novel gives you the opportunity in talking about kind of massive tragedies to focus in on individuals in a way that sometimes news stories kind of blur them together. An example I think of every time with this is the classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut about the firebombing at Dresden, which is about this tragedy that's so big it's, you can't even wrap your head around it, but he uses humor and surreal ideas and science fiction to kind of make you feel something different about it.
This takes place in a town you call Seldom Falls. I mean, you could take that name in several different ways. How come you came up with that name?
I was very pleased with myself when I came up with that name.
Well done, Tom.
Yeah, I spent days actually just writing possible names. I wanted some sort of water name in there. I don't know why. And then when I finally stumbled into that, I felt really, I really patted myself on the back for a full day probably. And then my wife was like, you just need to keep working on it. You know, you're not done. But I like the idea of just kind of a fictional central PA kind of town. I didn't want to lock myself into a specific town, but I feel like a lot of rural towns have similar characteristics. I want it to be small town for sure, because it's always, oh, we didn't think it could happen here, but it's where it happens.
Well, it describes itself, or it had described itself, as America's friendliest city. So here you have America's friendliest city where this horrific shooting takes place.
Yeah, and you know, that's part of the media narrative that often comes up, is looking for those the ironies and saying, you know, they want to have B-roll of the main street and show the cute diner and the people saying this is not what it's like here. And I think we're kind of fundamentally dishonest about what it's like in both cities and rural places, that, you know, where a lot of people, including me, are complicit in like pushing the idea that the city is the place where violence happens and the suburbs and the rural areas are the place where people are safe. And it's just not the case.
Tell us about Anna, and I quoted something that she had said. It's a pretty shocking thing that she said about, we send our children to school to get shot. But tell us about how you created her.
So I spent a long time struggling to get started on the book. I had notes, and originally I wanted to do a huge book about, from the perspectives of a dozen different characters. And she was the only one I was actually interested in continuing to write as I was doing it. And what I like actually is specifically the voice. And I really enjoy, I had a lot of fun writing those kinds of lines where that are hyperbolic, but also I think have a kernel of truth. And, you know, I liked, I thought of her as, you know, a woman who spent most of her life trying to kind of play by the rules and be polite and be nice to people and so, you know, do the things you're supposed to do. And now she's fed up because she says none of it has worked and I'm still stuck here. I'm still being treated badly. I'm still surrounded by violence and danger and so on.
Well, she is a fired teacher. Her boss says to her at one point, you're not an easy person to employ. So you have created is difficult. I'm not sure difficult is quite the right word, but she's complicated to say the least, but she has ideas. I mean, even that little section, and there are a bunch of them in this book, it's jaw-dropping in a lot of ways, what she says.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing that appealed to me, too, is I think that, I mean, there's a huge canon of fiction, both on TV and movies and in books, about difficult and unlikable male protagonists. Mm-hmm. And there are obviously female protagonists, too, but there seems to be a little bit less leeway for them, or people saying, well, why isn't she more likable? And I really enjoy reading books with unlikable female narrators.
Why?
I think part of it, there's sort of a freedom to those narrators. It's almost like, so men are often encouraged to have this period in their life where they will kind of throw off the shackles of society and like they're celebrated for it. And women, I think, are often scorned for doing the same thing. And so to me, when there's a female narrator who says, no, I'm not going to play by the rules anymore, there's a lot of narrative freedom, and also it's kind of thrilling to see this person just kind of break the rules that are set for them.
Well, and she sees that she is, at least for about a 24-hour period, she is a suspect in this case. She sees it on the TV monitor.
Yeah, and when it was kind of a breakthrough for me as far as how to actually plot the book. It was after the Boston bombings at the marathon. I was thinking there was the desperate manhunt on the internet where lots of people had decided, I'm going to solve this case. And they were basically well-meaning people, I think. But there's this weird mom mentality and people get carried away. And there was – I forget the names of the people. I'm glad I forget the names of the people. But there was two young men who were on the cover of the New York Post, I think, suggesting they had done the bombing. And they were just two young guys who happened to be brown-skinned and by the finish line. And so I thought about how someone's life could be totally ruined just because the internet gets carried away. Basically.
Well, and the media as well. And in many ways, this book is a critique of the media, how the media can exacerbate a situation like this, you know, make someone a suspect, dig through their life. And at some point she says, you know, my life is about seeking for forgiveness for things I hadn't done. I mean, every little infraction that she engaged in or fictional one is there on display.
Yeah, and that's another thing. And again, I think it's very often it's well-meaning people trying to get to the bottom of a story and they forget that there's a human attached to the side of this. And so they dig through every Instagram post and everything. Their friends share things that they had on Facebook and just all these scraps of people's lives. Mm-hmm. Like in here, some nude photos she had surface and then I think that person kind of gets discarded. I mean, the earliest example in my life that I can think of is Richard Jewell, who was accused of the Atlanta bombing in the Olympics at 96. And his life was basically ruined by
it
that.
Was.
You can't get away from it.
And it's on his backpack, I think.
Yeah, right, right. And that's a precursor. That would have been 10 times worse for him if the internet was what it is now, because it would have the pace of it was so different. And there were more... There was more money in newsrooms and more editors involved, able to put the brakes on some things, too.
Mm-hmm. But, so for her, it's like, how do I get my life back?
Yeah. And she's in a small town, the sort of town where everybody sort of knows a little bit about everyone's business anyway. And so that's – if she stays there forever, people are going to say like, oh, there's that crazy teacher.
Yeah.
And some people are going to be convinced no matter what that she was involved in some way or she did something wrong.
I want to have you read a chapter titled How to Be Safe. And, of course, the novel is titled How to Be Safe. Let's just do the first paragraph there. I had pulled out two, but let's just do the first one.
Sure. Every night before bed, make sure all your windows and doors are locked. Blow out every candle. Turn off your stove and your oven. Check outlets and light switches for loose connections. Cut strategic holes in the drywall to inspect for black mold. Search your toilet for stowaway snakes. Check your windows again. Set up a series of booby traps between your bed and the front door. Pray to whichever god is most likely to protect you from harm. Make peace with the ghosts in your home. Remove all suffocation hazards from the vicinity of your bed. There should be no plastic bags near your bed. Keep a phone on your bedside table pre-dialed to 911. Take a sleeping pill so you can get through the night, but don't take too many. In the morning, check your windows again.
It's a really strong paragraph. I mean, it's both ridiculous and hilarious and scary.
Yeah, you know, definitely parts of this book are some of my anxieties coming through, too. I'm a window checker.
Are frequently. You really?
Yeah.
Checking for what?
To make sure I've locked them. And my wife and I have gotten into some debates about her, how she's lax about locking the windows and how it doesn't matter. And but the then I enjoyed kind of pushing it to the next level, kind of the absurdity of this. And, you know, for me, as I was writing it, I kept thinking, too, like, whatever she does, and I think this is the subtext there, too, whatever she does, like, doesn't guarantee safety anyway. Right. Something could happen. There could be a fire. There could be a break-in. You could get sick. All those things are out of your control, basically.
Is that a revelation for you?
Yeah, and not a good one, I don't think.
That we think we can do all these things to protect us.
Yeah, create all these structures and systems to protect ourselves. And, you know, I thought of this a lot. My wife and I went to Paris over the summer last year, and my mom was very concerned about terrorism. And so I emailed her every night to let her know we were safe. But, you know, I'm more likely to have gotten in a car accident driving across the Ben Franklin Bridge to come here today. With the book, Anna's problem is that she can't stop thinking about that stuff. And I think probably the only way to stay sane is to find a way to make peace with that, you know, to know, like, there are some risks in my day and I'm going to have to live with that. Then again, there are other risks that maybe we shouldn't be expected to take. And that's where she's so angry about the shootings.
Absolutely. And I do think the school shootings sort of play into that existential anxiety that we have about how to live in the world, how to protect the people that we love from things that could happen to them that we actually don't have control over.
Right. Yeah, because where they happen are the places that we used to think of as safe spaces, schools, churches, movie theaters. I mean, movie theaters, not the same category as a church, but no one thought of it as a dangerous place. Concerts, there are spaces where you go to get away from the other things. And that's gone. I think that illusion, especially for the generation of students who've grown up now doing these drills, the active shooter drills, that illusion is completely gone. And Columbine happened when I was in high school, and so I didn't quite have that in the same way. But.
Well, and there was a young woman quoted basically, I'm not going to get her words exactly right, but responding to being a student today, just saying, well, you know, this is the new normal.
Yeah, and that's... horrible. Yeah, it's 12-year-olds saying that sort of stuff, that they go to school saying, like, well, of course I might get shot. And that's – there's – to me, what drives Anna in the book, but what drove me in writing the book too, is the weird complacency that people who are not only pro-gun activists but also anti-gun activists, a lot of people have this kind of a complacency, like, well, I guess this is what it's going to be. And it's very frustrating to think that we've just accepted that that's the situation now.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tom McAllister, our guest on Radio Times today. He's a novelist talking about his second book, and it's titled How to Be Safe. His first book, and he was a guest on Radio Times about a year and a half ago talking about it, The Young Widower's Handbook. You can join us. Any questions or comments? We'll have another reading as well. Call us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Tom McAllister about his new novel called How to Be Safe. It's about a school shooting that takes place in a small Pennsylvania town, the aftermath of what happens after that shooting. And the story is told by a fired teacher who is a suspect for about 24 hours. Her name is Anna Crawford. And McAllister is joining us on Radio Times to talk about this new book and why he chose to take on school shooting, the news media, and America's gun culture. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. Excuse me. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I quoted one thing that Anna said in my introduction. Let me quote something else. She writes a letter to her congressman because she has a solution for how to deal with the problem of gun violence. And I'll just read two sentences here. Instead of manufacturing bulletproof vests, she says, and bulletproof glass, perhaps you can't always be in a vest or behind a glass. We should begin manufacturing bulletproof children. It will be expensive, but who can put a price on the life of a child? you're really pushing things there. And as I read that, I was reminded of something I probably read in high school by Jonathan Swift, A Modest Proposal for Preventing the Children of Poor People from Being a Burden to Their Parents or Country and Making Them Beneficial to the Public. He wrote this back in the 1700s about what to do with poverty and hungry children in Ireland.
That's one of those lines that as I wrote it, and there's a number of lines in this book that as I wrote them, I thought, you know, that's what's the most ridiculous thing you can come up with. And then, and yet, earlier this year, there are people, they've started marketing, I think, Kevlar backpacks, talking about actually putting students in vests and put bulletproof doors. And it's just,
And you said, well, why not bulletproof children?
Yeah.
Or she says.
Yeah. And it's just amazing the various lengths people will go to avoid talking about the actual weapon that's used in actually injuring the children, and just instead creating lots and lots of different expensive, probably useless solutions.
She blames something that she calls toxic masculinity. At some point, she says, you write, as soon as Adam discovered his erection, the world was doomed. Do you see it that way? Toxic masculinity.
Yeah. And well, one thing I liked about one reason that I wrote this book from a female perspective, which is not something I'd done very much at all in my life as a writer, not even as a student. Once I wrote a very bad story from the perspective of a woman as an undergraduate, but
buried somewhere,
it's like a rite
right?
of passage. One reason that I was interested in her is because I realized the book was not just so much about shootings or guns, but about that idea of vulnerability. And on a day-to-day, the average woman has more vulnerabilities than the average male does. I guess that's the concept of privilege, which I know is a term people have sort of soured on. But the idea that my wife, if she wants to take the subway home by herself at 10 p.m., has a lot more things to worry about than I do. Where what I'm worried about is I hope the train's not late. Mm. And she's worried about her safety in lots of different ways. And so that's where a lot of the stuff in here that I enjoyed writing the most is kind of broadening out, using the incident of the gun to talk about the bigger issues of how Anna feels like her whole life she's had to be on the defensive.
And men have hurt her. I mean, she has been hurt by men.
She has, yeah. And an eye-opening thing for me reading, you know, actually this is where social media has its downsides, but one positive is being, for me, has been being exposed to the work of lots and lots of really smart, thoughtful women. And when stuff comes up after during the Me Too movement or a few years ago, there was like there was a hashtag, it was Yes All Men or Yes All Women, sorry, where almost every woman I know has some story about having been sexually intimidated or harassed or assaulted or many stories like that. And it's really made an impression on me how prevalent it was. And it's not just the headline stories.
Did you set out to try to understand the world from a woman's perspective, or was that more an accidental discovery?
Probably more of an accident. You know, as I was going, later on, as my agent was pitching the novel, my editor at LiveWrite said on the phone, "What made you write a feminist novel?" And I said, "I didn't realize it was." I'm glad that you know, like, I was not upset that she said it, but it wasn't like a mission of the book. It just happened to be. I guess because of the stuff I've been reading and trying to do a better job of actually listening to people. A big discovery for me in my 20s was that listening to women helps you learn about them.
Well, good for you. Yeah. Well, that's all I can say.
Yeah, it only took a quarter century or so to figure it out. But, you know, I think that really informed the book. Right. And I wrote, this is not a book I could have written 10 years ago because I just didn't have the perspective or the worldview.
And what, I don't want to give too much away, but we also see really the devolution of a small town. I mean, it begins to arm itself. There are militias. People are in the surveillance. I mean, it feels like it's kind of gone mad with this notion of how are we going to be safe? How are we going to protect ourselves?
Yeah, and I thought, you know, I think that's a lot of people right now, not just because of the wave of gun violence that our country's facing, but also because of lots of the other very depressing, negative, the political climate. A lot of people are kind of grasping for ways to feel some sort of solace. Some people are, you know, church fills that void. Other people don't feel the church does that. And so I think there's lots of, that's where you have lots of different online community, some of which are pretty toxic and some of which are very supportive. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I wanted to make sure there were lots of different versions of that showing up. And that's like the militia. I definitely had in mind like the Bundy family and the stuff they were doing. So I was probably writing this right as that standoff was happening in Oregon. But I think for all of them, it's like an attempt. It's a genuine attempt to try to make sense of a world that doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, and the mayor of the town tells the people, just act normally.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you can't.
Yeah, right.
We Nor need should to be, you, I think.
No. Yeah, I think that's actually a dangerous idea that, well, you know, and it's a common idea. After a terrorist attack, it's like, well, tomorrow we need to just move on. The first school shooting in the modern American history was this shooting, the Clock Tower shooting at University of Texas at Austin. And there's this really great documentary, I think called Tower, about it, where the most shocking thing to me was at the end, the survivor said, we never spoke about it again. There was no psychologists. There was no conversations. Our job was to pretend that that thing had never happened. And I think that probably destroyed some people.
I'm sure. Know? I mean, this needs to be talked about.
Yeah.
It's interesting you've referenced so many news stories. Yeah. And is that how you work as a novelist? Maybe consciously, maybe unconsciously.
Yeah. And for me, you know, so I mean, kind of a cliche of creative writing workshop advice is kind of follow your obsessions. And it's something, it's a cliche, but I think it's also useful. And it's one that I use all the time. And so it's stuff I was reading about anyway. I was reading Dave Cullen's book, Columbine. Uh-huh. That was really great. I was kind of following these stories a lot. And so, yeah, a lot of what this book has my notes. I have a huge notes file, which ends up being a lot of just a hodgepodge of, you know, what can I pull from this crazy story about this, you know, this militia in Oregon? What can I pull from this shooting or this documentary I watched, and trying to synthesize them into something that makes sense to me?
Lots of notebooks? Is that what you use? Or
My handwriting is too bad for a notebook.
Oh, is that right?
It's just a long, long Word document and stuff on my phone.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Tom McAllister. And again, he's a novelist. He teaches at Temple University. And his new book, his second novel, is published, and it's called How to Be Safe. And it's really about the aftermath of a school shooting in a small Pennsylvania town. And again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. The book begins with the shooter. I mean, he's an unnamed shooter. He stops at a pizza shop. I mean, there's nothing more every day than going somewhere and getting a slice of pizza.
Right.
But you have him at sort of on his way to do his deed. He gets a pizza.
Yeah. And there was, I forget the story now. It was a recent story like that. One of the more recent shootings, there was video of the guy going to get a slice of pizza beforehand. And I was thinking about, when I was writing it, I was just thinking about right up until the moment of that shooting, they're just a regular kid.
Exactly.
Doing regular kid things. And all of a sudden they become this other thing, you know, this kind of mythological figure of fear who becomes a hero to some people, and just this presence. Which is part of the motivation to do it, I think, for some of them. But yeah, so I was interested. I really wasn't interested in like actually describing the shooting itself, right.
It's more inside his head as he prepares.
Yeah, yeah. I was interested kind of just in that moment before, and then let's jump to right after and see the damage that it's done, and not so much worry about the bloodshed and all that stuff.
And not to give him a name.
Right. Yeah.
Was that important to you?
Definitely. Yeah. And that's where I know there are some. After every one of these shootings, there will be a number of people saying, often psychologists saying, like, please don't name them, don't put their face on TV, don't read their manifesto. And I think the news has gotten a little better about that. I remember after the Virginia Tech shooting, the shooter, his face was on TV constantly, right. Always in the background. I think they've tried to move away from it. I mean, I think they have to name them because that's part of the story, but maybe it's shifting the focus away from not just talking about this boy's troubles and instead focusing on who did he hurt.
In fact, we'll have a psychiatrist who'll be joining us after we're done with you, Tom, to talk about that. Let me read an email from Kristen. She says, my daughter's 9, will be attending middle school next year. I've requested a face-to-face with all 3 of her principals in her current school, the middle school and high school, to sit down and talk about what they intend to do to keep our children safe from gun violence. Does your guest have any suggestions about what questions to pose? I mean, that's chilling email.
It is, and it's so sad that that's the question that so many parents have. And I have a 6-year-old niece who's going to start next year, and I think she's going to have to do the active shooter drills. And, you know, it's horrifying to think. I think about this from the perspective as a college professor, where we do drills and we have the alert systems and all that stuff. But I'm at Temple, where we have, I think, 30,000 people, 30,000 students on campus. You can't lock that down. No. You know, if something happens, it's going to happen. And I don't even know. And I think so parents have to ask that question to their teachers or to the principals and the administrators. But I also don't know what good answers there are, which is I know is not an encouraging answer. Because to make us feel better, there has to be some sort of cultural change that starts way before we even have kids in school. You know, that starts with maybe not celebrating male violence and celebrating like the Rambo character as much as we do. But it's an uphill battle that other people have been fighting for decades. But
well, I'd love to have you actually read another section from the book. And this jumps ahead. And there's a question about what kind of memorial to create in this town to memorialize the people that were lost in this school shooting.
I told him my idea anyway. What I envisioned was this. No memorial at all. No stone. No American flags every 3 feet. No ribbons. No priests and no Bible. No symbolic floral arrangements to represent vitality or youth or rebirth. No poet reading a poem about rising from the ashes. No obelisks, for God's sake. Just dig a huge hole and fill it with guns. A hole so deep you could see the magma bubbling beneath us. Have everyone come from around the country and throw their guns into the hole. Fill it up with nitrate-rich soil. Fill it and fill it until the hole is overflowing, then walk away. Allow the earth to process the guns and turn them into something beautiful. The earth can turn coal into diamonds. Imagine what it could do with guns. Wait until the guns sprout from the ground and flower and see what new resources present themselves. After the flood, you get rainbows. After the fire, you get mushrooms. After the shooting, you just get more shootings unless you do something different.
Which speaks to what you said earlier about Sandy. I mean, I think that was the horrifying shock. I remember President Obama referencing that. If after the massacre of first graders doesn't bring about some kind of change, then what kind of country are we?
Yeah, and it even got worse in some ways because there's the conspiracy theories that the families there had faked the deaths of their children or didn't even have children, and so the mania got turned up. And there are a lot of people have said that exact sentiment, like, well, if Sandy Hook didn't fix it, what, nothing's going to. And I feel that sometimes too, but then I also want to push back against that kind of the nihilism of it, just to say like, oh, well, we're done. I guess this is just what we are. You know, there has to be, you know, if Godzilla's marauding through town, I feel like you have to at least try to stop him. You don't just say like, well, I guess he's going to crush the building. But that's what it feels like sometimes, mm-hmm. that there's this inevitability. But that's how a lot of political fights have felt for centuries, too, that it feels inevitable that you're never going to win. And then suddenly there's some turn.
Something happens.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, it's a sort of hopeful thing. You can, you know, bury and flowers sprout and who knows what.
She's not the most hopeful person, but no. I liked having at least a couple of moments where she could express the possibility that something could get better. You know, like just the slightest ray of sunshine, you know.
There are some eulogies in this book, and at what point, I guess she says, or certainly you write, I'm not sure what obituaries are for. I should say obituaries. You can't tell people's stories, but nothing you do is complete or accurate. It's just a list of people they used to know and the jobs they used to do. We spend so much time trying to be more effective mourners, but we have no idea how to do it. Even elephants are better at mourning. And elephants, to see an elephant mourn is to, for me anyway, just bring tears to my eyes.
Yeah. It's so there's, I think in all the sections, almost every section, there's been wildlife stuff too. So talking about how I just bring in everything I've been reading and watching. I watch a lot of nature documentaries too. So, but yeah, I had that in mind. So there's these sections in here about the victims where she kind of gives sometimes one paragraph about Kelsey was this, she was an honor student, whatever. And I like that idea. I enjoyed writing those because I feel like, I mean, that's what we do. We try to boil them down to, okay, this was the hero teacher. This was the girl who was the honors math student. This was the valedictorian. But I kind of like thinking of them in these other ways, these little ways you know them. This is the guy that I knew because he worked at the deli and things like that. To me, that's a more meaningful way to remember someone. Mm.
Was this a hard book for you to write?
It was. From a very practical standpoint, it was hard to figure out a structure and to figure out what to do with it. And initially, it was just lots of disconnected snippets of one-liners and angry thoughts and jokes and trying to find some way, things that I thought were jokes that other people probably don't think are funny. But then it was actually, I guess cathartic is sort of the word I'm looking for, but it's not, I guess catharsis suggests that now that problem has been taken care of. But it felt good to articulate some of these things that had just been kind of weighing on me for years.
Do you feel better now?
Sort of. But, you know, I would feel better if it felt like anything was changing out there in the world outside of this, the very small world of people who've experienced this book.
Were you, we have a guest who I should say is stuck in traffic. So we're in the process of getting our second guest squared away. So I do want you to stay with us for just a couple more minutes. How old were you when you began writing?
I started writing. So my dad was a very serious reader. We had books everywhere, piled all over the house. He read a lot of crime thrillers and sci-fi books and things like that. I think the first short story I wrote where people gave me some praise was sixth or seventh grade.
Really?
And then, you know, as a vain child, I just desperately kept chasing praise for decades. In high school, I was really fortunate. I went to LaSalle High School here in the Philly suburbs, and I was really fortunate to have some teachers who were really, really encouraged me to work on that stuff. And then at LaSalle University, I had a teacher named Justin Cronin who kind of was the first person to show me what it is to be a real, like a serious writer, to take writing seriously. So the first real stories that I feel okay about, I was writing probably in my late 20s, or early 20s, sorry.
Well, hold on. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Tom McAllister, our guest, he's a novelist. He also teaches at Temple University. And we've been talking about his brand new book called How to Be Safe. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just said goodbye to Tom McAllister, and his new novel, How to Be Safe, focuses on the aftermath of a school shooting, its impact on a small, fictional Pennsylvania town. And it does raise a number of timely and real-life questions about how students who survive a mass killing can cope, how the media can exacerbate the event, and why the search to understand a motive can be so elusive. Stephen Berkowitz joining us by cell phone. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist, also associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, where he directs the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. Stephen Berkowitz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, and sorry, Philadelphia traffic, what can I say?
Well, we're not going to blame you, but I appreciate that we're hooked up by telephone because we definitely wanted to have you in on this show to talk in more depth about a number of things, including what it takes for a community, whether it's a town or even a school, to survive some kind of shooting. And we should say that yesterday was the graduation at the Parkland School in Florida. What helps a person, a community, even a country, deal with the aftermath of a violent shooting?
Well, there are a number of things that can be helpful, but probably the most crucial thing is to be able to stay connected, to have support among community members that allows them to feel that they're not in this alone, that they have a shared experience, and they have people who understand the impact on individuals and the community. Without that, people tend to feel increasingly isolated. No one can really understand their experience, and there's some truth to that, other than those who have been through it. So that's really the essential foundation for any sort of recovery.
Well, I'm thinking, about those high school students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School and what they have done since February, in many ways organizing protests, being interviewed by a lot of the media. Do you think that has been helpful for them?
I think another aspect that can be very, very helpful in recovery is to become active in a pro-social way. And I have no doubt that this was helpful to them. With that said, you know, the trauma and the lingering effects of it are still there. And while in some ways this is very important to be active, it also can be a sort of form of distraction at times. And you know, in a way, it permits you not to focus specifically on what's going on for you. So it's not in lieu of treatment, but it is absolutely a useful piece to do. And I think that's true nationally too. Marches, you know, donations, collections, things like that can really help people recover from these events and from the overwhelming nature of how they're feeling.
But I also hear you saying that it's important for an individual or even a community to process that internally and I guess maybe not even get distracted by some of these public events.
Absolutely. One of the things that is always hard, I think, for us to understand, because we see this in such a public way, is that everybody's response and reaction is subjective and is individual, because you know they bring their own experiences and their own lives to it, and so if you don't process it in your own way with support and help, you're not really doing what you need to do to recover most effectively.
Anytime something like this happens, I'm sure I'm not alone in this. I just, you know, the question is why? You know, why, especially with something that's more, shall we say, anonymous, where mass shooting seems to be more anonymous, even if there is some kind of reason for it. But how important, and can we answer that question, why?
We can take up a couple shows on that.
I figure.
But I think one way to think about it in a context is mass shootings that have increasingly occurred, particularly at schools, have also occurred in a context where we have increased rates of suicide. We have incredible number of deaths due to overdose, particularly of opiates. And these are all part and parcel of the same despair and hopelessness that I think is becoming increasingly rampant in this country, and actually particularly, I think, among youth. So that, you know, one way to think about a suicide, and this is not completely accurate, but when one kills themselves, they're also killing everybody else in the world.
Wow.
It's an aggressive act, and mass shootings in a way are almost the complete obverse. They are outwardly clearly an aggressive act, but you're also removing yourself from the world, and you know, whether it's through incarceration or death when you're yourself are killed in the process. And for many of our kids, and we saw this with Nicholas Cruz and some others, they feel such despair, such isolation, hopelessness, such a sense of marginalization that they basically say, I'm going to do this because it's the only way I'm going to get any sense that I matter. And, you know, that can be true of a lot of acts, suicide, other types of antisocial behavior. It's a way of mattering when you feel so hopeless and so in such despair.
In fact, Nicholas Cruz, and he is the shooter in Parkland, Florida, posted a video, and there were some news organizations that posted what he said. Others decided not to. And he certainly talks in chilling detail about what he is going to do. And he also says something to the effect that, you know, now you're going to know my name. I'm curious about whether you think, like, how much attention should we give to a particular shooter, and whether the media is complicit in posting videos like that?
I think I have several answers. I think one thing is unfortunately the horse has left the barn.
It's too late.
That with social media and so forth, it's almost impossible for people not to have access to this information. I wish that we did not report names and these kinds of videos, because I do think there's a contagion effect, and you know we've seen that. And there's good data to support that there is this effect that occurs. That there's increased risk of shootings, there's increased risk of suicide when they are, when they become public and the media reports on them. With that said, all you have to do is go online, and there are Columbine chat groups, almost glorifying the shooters, from the Columbine in 1999. So, I don't know how to address this. I do think it would be best to keep it quiet and not to make these individuals notorious. But I don't know if we can do that anymore, given our current media world.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Stephen Berkowitz. He's a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania. And we are talking about how young people, and frankly, all of us, can cope with the trauma of gun violence, especially things like mass shooting and some of the psychological factors that can lead someone to commit such a horrific act or a horrific crime. We had earlier in the hour, a novelist wrote a book about the aftermath of a school shooting. The book is called How to Be Safe. And Stephen, you said something in an op-ed a couple of months ago. This was actually after what happened in Parkland. And you said, one aspect of this kind of traumatic experience is that it represents a breach of the social contract. If I act appropriately, I will be safe. Repairing that breach requires justice, not just convicting the perpetrator, but a lasting societal response to the episode. The lack of a response from our society is justice denied, which perpetuates the trauma response, the traumatic response, and impairs the ability to heal. Tell us what you're saying there.
Well, so a lot.
Yeah, a lot.
One way of thinking about a traumatic experience, such as a school shooting, is that it's a failure of our societal structure. That, one of the ways we exist in our society is, if I, behave reasonably, I follow the rules, I do what I'm supposed to do, society is going to protect me. It will take care of me. And when that does not take place, there's a wrench in our belief in the rule of law and how our society functions. And one of the ways that we reclaim that feeling is when justice is served. And too often we think of it just in the criminal, justice sense of there's a trial and there's a conviction. But that's, that can often ring hollow in many of these situations. The question is how does society respond to correct what is a glaring void in the way we manage these kinds of situations and prevent them? And so, my point in that op-ed piece is that when we just give lip service to the changes that are required after such a horrific kind of event as a mass shooting in a school, and nothing is really accomplished. No real legislature, no real social or community action. It continues to perpetuate that feeling that there is this breach in our social contract and perpetuates trauma.
Well, certainly, one of the responses has been, well, let's arm teachers. Let's, you know, make sure that the schools have all sorts of security devices so that children can be safe. Is that not a response?
I think it's a minimal response. I don't want to get into the arming teachers debate, but I'm sorry.
That's all right. I know you're in your car.
Yeah. I don't necessarily think that's the best approach. I have no problem with increasing the number of school resource officers and using metal detectors in schools. It's an unfortunate necessity. But we all know that that's just not sufficient, and that the all-too-easy access to weapons that can kill multiple people or even individuals is one of the great dilemmas in this country. I mean, no other country in the world has this kind of issue, despite, you know, similar rates of mental illness and whatnot. And I think that it is this easy access that allows for these horrific events to occur. And we see this, we've seen this in, you know, all these school shootings, that, you know, guns in the home, kids having ready access to these guns allows them to act out their despair. And, you know, without some really considerable impact on the access to guns, justice has been denied. And I think the Parkland students have made that very clear, by and large.
We're almost out of time here. Are you talking about a more, quote unquote, public health approach to this problem, this crisis?
Absolutely. The public health approach is, you know, always trying to figure out what the vector is, what is transmitting this epidemic. And in this case, it's weapons, it's guns.
The vector meaning like a virus?
Right. Well, you know, so a virus is transmitted by mosquitoes, right, for instance. And one way of dealing with that is to decrease or eradicate the mosquitoes that carry that virus. So guns, you know, are the vector by which killings occur.
Stephen Berkowitz, thank you so much. I'm sorry you couldn't make it into the studio, but I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's Stephen Berkowitz. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist, also an associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He directs the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery. We began our hour with a novelist, Tom McAllister, who's an associate professor at Temple University, author of a new book called How to Be Safe. A Facebook message from Melissa. There is a reason to be hopeful. There are millions of people working to pass strict gun laws. We are the only country with this problem. And it's because of weak gun laws. We need everyone's voice. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.